political arena as a sphere where decisions are made, and therefore of great significance to the Christian, and one cannot escape. As I warned at the beginning of the paragraph, while the point is made more sharply in such a rhetorical form, the danger is that it oversimplifies the point and is in danger of really destroying the truth and its delicacy. The Church, in seeking new forms today, must not sever itself from its historic roots. If part of the question of yesterday morning took this approach, we recall. But isn't there a great continuity? We have indeed a living continuity with the Church throughout history, including the history in the immediate past. And in every attempt to seek a new form, brethren, we run a risk of pride. It's so easy to feel that we alone, you know, of all people, see the meaning of the Church in the contemporary world. It's so easy for us to feel that our models are going to be the prototypes for the 21st century. I think in every new form, we run the risk of a false judgment. The inner city and the college campus, these are not the only legitimate frontiers in the late 20th century. In every new form, we run the risk of apostasy. Our attempt to serve may lead to an accommodation that's the latest in a long line of genuine desires to meet the world, of which, of course, the compromise of the faith once delivered. Now, we're saying, brethren, if you want a line of dangers, I think I can do it with you, and say there's a very thin line, and when you move over this, you're falling into the pit. But having said this, we still have to move forward. Let's investigate some implications of this view of the Church manifestly present in the world through its members raising signs to God. Let's highlight for a minute the necessary complementary nature of the work of clergy and laity as part of this whole people of God. Then let's think together about the implication of the work of the Church in its gathered form. And finally, let's describe the three areas in which God's people might raise signs to him in the world. First then, need recovery of this sense, and now I'm not talking theory, brethren, because all of you can talk the theory with me, but we're asking, how is this going to work? A recovery on our parish, our circuit, our district level, of the sense of the manifold ministries within the Church, and to see their essential unity in Christ reconciling ministry for the world. The term manifold ministry speaks to the mutual and the complementary needs which clergy and laity have. Pastors are needed, and this is not an anti-clerical approach, you see. Pastors are needed to proclaim and interpret the Word of God, to administer the sacraments, to pronounce the absolution, to publicly, in quotes, represent the Church. In place of diminishing then the pastoral office, of denigrating it, this recognition frees it from many cultural expectations and from many misunderstandings. A recognition of the manifold ministries within the Church will prevent the development of a laicism in place of a former clericalism. And I think you would agree that a distortion in one direction is as deleterious as one in the opposite direction. Let's try this out for ourselves as clergymen. Notice what has happened in the average congregation. It seems to me that with no conscious attempt to direct the development in this fashion, a situation has arisen in which the clergyman has become the central figure. Virtually everything that happened in the congregation involved him. He was responsible. If the Church became successful, he was known as a skilled organizer, a builder, a successful preacher. And I say this smilingly. If a member of his congregation shot his wife or embezzled from his employer, there arose a dark, unvoiced suspicion about the true inner quality of his ministry. It was taken for granted further that the interests of his congregation would reflect the pastor's own predilections. And here all we have to do is look from one congregation to the other and know the minister in charge. If a man personally was interested in liturgy and youth work, let's say, the program of the parish very quickly reflected his own bent over against the neighboring preacher whose chief interests were preaching and the lodge question. Now, the judgment was made, I think he's out of the air. Now, the judgment has been made that this congregational pattern has made the Church dependent upon the minister in this last century and a half to a degree that has been unknown in the history. answered absolute. I personally am hedging out of a little bit because of the church historians seated in the room. More accurately, we might say that Romans sees a cycle in which the church slips repeatedly into a pattern of overdependence upon the clergy. Dependence certainly was not the pattern in the first 300 years of the church's history before Constantine. Our dependence upon a professional class of clergy would have been almost incomprehensible to them. During the period of the Middle Ages, the separation between cleric and layman became so great that the layman was relegated to a second-class position. Early reform movements and the reformations attempted to correct this abuse. The father of the family was to assume the immediate spiritual care of his family, and the Lutheran pastor was not to assume the role of the former cleric. For the ordained was given the special ministry of word and sacrament. So the laity was given the ministry of carrying out their tasks of witness and of service in each calling of life where God had placed them. But we're saying the cycle has moved on once more. A man at a university, a dean, was commenting just about 10 days ago. He said, you know, as close as I can see it, and he happens to be a Lutheran, the minister today has become the executive director of the congregation in precisely the same way that you see an executive director of any voluntary agency in a big city. This affected, as we've been trying to indicate, the general direction which the interest of a congregation would assume, but it also limited, by definition, the amount of activity in which a local church could engage. So it was passively assumed by both pastor and people that he would be in touch with every program. Since he was responsible if anything went wrong, the pastor generally tried to keep abreast of the activities of each group by attending as many of the meetings as possible. And further, to be very critical of ourselves, often unsure of his basic position in the larger society, this dependence of groups and individuals upon him was reassuring and just a little flattering. While maintaining the proper outward posture of humility, some pastors ruled their tiny ecclesiastical empires as kings. Because of their supposed theological expertise, the layman assumed this was the only method of conducting church life. Now the point is that the total activity of the church was strictly dependent upon the relationship which a single individual, the pastor, can establish. When the man had unusual drive and ability, this activity increased. But the inherent limitation remained. I add in parenthesis, modern studies of industry show quite clearly how many men a given individual can supervise. If you're talking about real supervision as you know it in an office, one senior manager can only keep up with seven individuals who are heading sub-departments. Seven. He can establish in a factory personal relationships of a quality with 200 people, and this is the upper limit. And we're saying by unconsciously assuming the model of a manager of industry, and to save a lot of faulty discussion, may I again say, unconsciously assuming this model, the pastor falls under all of the limitations that are involved in the model. And further, I think he's also quite ignorant of administrative procedures which modern business method takes for granted. But all of the perversion of role and the foreshortening of purpose associated with this position has been the target of the new investigations of the true role of the laity. Maybe it struck you that the impetus for this new stress upon laity began with the clergy. It wasn't by and large in most areas laymen who were coming up with this awareness. Many pastors were more unhappy with the limitations than were some laity who calmly accepted the status quo as the natural pattern of church life. The goal is to reestablish a working pattern of church life wherein it is apparent that all of God's people are chosen to work in the kingdom and that His Spirit endows all of them with gifts. The Bible presents a picture of a basic equality of calling among God's people, even while they have different functions. In spite of all of our words about Christian calling as being of God and us holy, we remain as clergymen in a task set apart. There are seminar circles, one or two of you in the room right now, I think who have written most capably about the task of the clergy to nourish, to equip, to sustain the laity in their ministries in the world. therefore, let us continue to focus upon the lady. Now, at this point, we're seeing ourselves maybe become a little more concrete. We've got this layman, and we're dealing with the whole supposition to this point. What's it going to look like? What will this man actually be doing? And now in three on your outline, I'd like to have you think for a second about the two tasks. May I make very clear, I feel that part of what he's going to be doing is going to remain within the setting of the congregation. I think I've already made clear that over against another set of men who could be standing at the podium right now, I think we don't have to junk the parish and the congregations we know of right now. There are a few men who are so disgusted with it, country club, the stained glass windows approach, that they say the faster we forget it and start fresh, the better it's going to be. However, I have enough of a sense sociologically that institutions don't change, don't blow up the whole thing, and romantically try to jump back 2,000 years or begin fresh in the year 1965. I'd like to rather ask, given these as goals and given our parish, what state might it take? Let's look at three points within the setting of the parish, and let's look at three within the world. Part of the layman's task is going to be carried on within the setting of the congregation. All that I think is that in the past this has been the exclusive domain of this service. We should say that we're running a calculated risk in describing this area of activity first. Many of you know Gibbs and Morton's very stimulating little book for laymen, God's Chosen People. And when they talk about this area, it's only after they talk about all of the others they finally tuck in a chapter and say, well, there are a few things he has to do within the congregation too, but let's get the pattern right. Let's start where we are and reverse it. Let's deliberately discuss this phase of responsibility first. Now, we're suggesting that we need a staging area, and that which should serve as the staging area must not become the end as well as the beginning. This has been our danger. Isn't it true that many of us have fallen into the danger of thinking, of the error rather, of feeling that our best laymen were those who remain closest to the staging area, those fellows that you see in the church basement 3 and 4 nights a week? They're always evidence. They never move too far outside of the crowd. These are the real laymen. Correction demands, however, that we see the legitimate and necessary tasks that have to be performed within the circle of fellow believers. Having already established the fact that we want to avoid crowd keeping, what tasks are there? I think most of us would agree that the local church will remain the center of much of the Christian corporate work. Many of the splendid experiments in moving Christians out into other spheres of life have failed, I think, from a Lutheran point of view, to see the necessity of maintaining the base at which Christians could offer their common praise and prayer and strengthen one another for the gospel. To make this more clear, I'm talking here about those who say that maybe we ought to send laymen for a year at a time, saying, here's where you are to witness in this community. We don't want to see you at St. Mark's for 1 full year. Maybe you start off with a 2-day retreat, you know, you multiply the hours, and say, listen, after 1 year of church activity and worship anyway, come back in 9 months. And my concern with this, I think it's great to say we ought to be commissioning the people out there, but we're asking, does it foreshorten the function of the gathering with the group for strength, for prayer, for offering common adoration? For one, I feel the rhythm of gathering before scattering remains necessary on a regular basis. The man of God has to be equipped before he carries out his role in the world. And I suspect it's much like sleep. You can't sleep for a week now and then forget it for the next 2.5 months. Further, needs a concentrated moment of expressing worship to God with fellow faithful. Indeed, for those of you who arise to say his whole life is to be an expression of worship, but this is usually reinforced for the one who does not exclude himself from the assembly of the believers. Let's take a step, though, being critical about this. Why is this group ready to simply cast off the need for worship altogether? The recent endeavors to make the life of the organized church relate more vitally to the full life of people, individually and corporately, has arisen, it seems to me, among those who, many of whom, I have been associated with liturgical revival. This is a group that's saying, don't think of worship as being a withdrawal from life. It's a withdrawal to God, followed then by a more intense, conscious movement back into the callings of this world. This group has been very critical, however, of much of our worship in the immediate past. For it possesses the same sort of weakness that we were describing that arose from overdependence upon the clergy. Worshippers have played an overly passive role. Too often, in spite of our words, they have been spectators. This probably reached its height during the sermon, where more of us than we would like to confess become the prima donna, performing the role that 9 out of 10 of us cherish most. Our language, our thought structures, the quality of our theology, a genuine understanding of the depth, of the diversity, of the lives of those worshiping with us, is so often sadly deficient. Now ask why. I'd like to press each one of these a little bit. The problem arose from a process of reducing people to a least common denominator. The least common denominator arrived at by asking about their relationship to the organized life of the church. This is the second point on the outline you'll notice, in which I think we're going to find church members legitimately engaged in this coming period. However, church organizations will know a change of direction from that which has characterized local church life in America over at least the last 2 generations. Has it ever struck you why we make such a point that we are different as Lutherans from Protestants? How similar our organizational life is with the rest of the Protestant churches in our community? While the names will vary from one denomination to another, the basic thrust and pattern of organizations for men, women, and young people are strikingly the same. By falsely seeing the assembled church as the absolute center of the church's purpose, most of the energies of such groups have been directed toward crowd people. Think of your own women's organization for those of you who are parish pastors. Some of us shudder as we think of the men of ability gathered in some of our churches and the low level of work presented to them. I just spent about 6 hours last week with a group at one of our very large manufacturing firms, Monsanto. And you see the ability of these guys in management, one after the other, and you discover that 4 out of 5 are members of a church. And then you press them, and you say, what is it you're doing in that church? And you find you dry up inside. Well, you see at what point we have tried to tap these men of fantastic ability. This is even more striking, it seems to me, among our educated women. One can understand why in such large numbers they will have nothing to do with the organizational life of our churches. As clergy, we often have failed to hear what they've been trying to say to us, and in some cases, we've been unconsciously piqued that they weren't applauding the whole program of my church. We were dealing with them, we're saying, as partial people. Instead of seeing them in the richness of all of their relationships to one another in the world, we saw them only in relationship to the local church. This is not the best illustration, but let's take a simple story with it. In place of seeing a man as a doctor, in a position of tremendous responsibility at the local hospital, one who needed all of the aid that fellow Christians could possibly give in supporting him in his crucial role, so often we saw him as one who was too busy, and therefore a poor attender of church services, and further, as one who took no part in the organizational life of the church. And that parenthetically used it primarily, as a prestige point. Dr. So-and-so, yes, he's a member of St. Mark's. Some parishes are working hard to correct this. Some of the cell discussion groups have moved far in this direction. For in them, a man consciously brings to bear all that he is in his personal and professional life. Now, with you, I wonder whether the present proliferation of small discussion groups will amount to something more than a current ecclesiastical fad that will soon run its course. No program or emphasis can be expected to maintain interest for long. And we have sure proved this to one another within the last 10 years. Thus, there are the ever-awakening attempts to revitalize the interest of church people who have become jaded with all of the programs we've conducted in the last decade. Potentially, it seems to me at least, these discussion groups could be more than another gimmick. They are a simple, structural form for permitting the people of God to carry out some of their central tasks more effectively. Ideally, they focus upon their purpose of bringing together the Word and people and life, rather than upon perpetuating their own organizational life. And if we're ready, it would seem to me, to see the individual group arising to meet a purpose, then it'll be born It'll accomplish its purpose for a while, and it will die. Another group will then arise to carry out its purpose. The local church can be of great assistance, then, if we see organizations in this light, of carrying people to newer heights of Christian, a responsible Christian living. The local church can still be a cross point at which some of the critical problems facing people are discussed in the light of the Christian faith. While no single Christian can be expected to be knowledgeable in a dozen areas of vital modern concern, the congregation should be encouraged to have different members of its fellowship to become as expert as possible in areas of interest to them. I hope this is clear enough without going into it. It's a main point that I didn't develop too much. I think some of you and some of our learners say, but you know, my word, how do you keep up with questions of Vietnam, questions of burgeoning populations, questions of mission fund, the question of birth control, and you line up 24 of these and say, how can I, including all the local issues of what we should be doing about integration and school issues and all the rest. We're suggesting the congregation really be the congregating point, at which a dozen, or each become slightly expert in a dozen of these fields, when we come together and we're saying, brethren, here's an area in which we Christians should be involved. Let me try to fill you in a little bit. And that meanwhile, when you're saying something has got to be done here, brother, and we're the one that's kept closer to this. This understanding then is to be shared with saying with a fellow Christian for growth, for correction, and for decisions concerning potential answers. When you're saying, you haven't looked at the whole picture, or when we agree, we do have to move. Such discussion must be, I hear the key word, it's got to be on an adult level. This means avoiding pre-digested topic studies, carefully removed from any area of conflict. In such groups, I'm merely going to trace a few background facts, 20 contemporary issues, and then discuss them in the abstract, talking about possible solutions for what I can do in Richmond Heights for India, for example. Little is going to be gained. Adult discussions will aim at being real, so that we really confront an issue about which we can do something and we wrestle till we come to this point. It means dealing with issues that are vital. It means that they're going to be therefore complex issues, and thus confusing and impossible easy solutions. Where possible, they're going to have to result in specific individual or corporate action. Christians also will be called to work in their local congregation in educating the younger generation of believers and also some of the adults. I wanted to comment here a little bit upon some of the tension that I feel that we've seen within the last summer as our national organizations are trying to aid the local church, but I think we better skip this particular part. Let's add this, though, simply to, in two sentences, wrap up this third point. It's during the early years of their lives that children and young people are determining in their own minds how vital the church is in their world. And if the church demonstrates that it's dealing only with peripheral items in highly dogmatic fashion, then when that young person becomes an adult and is able to make his own decision, we already see what happens. He begins to move away from the life of the church. The local church, then, we've said so far, is going to remain central as a place where people will worship, where the word is going to be brought to focus upon specific issues in life among fellow Christians, and where they will nurture the young in the faith. But a much greater part of this has to be taking place in the world. This is where we are going to be raising signs to God. Look at the last point. The Christian is called to participate vigorously in the life of his neighborhood as a leaven and a salt. A change has come in the very concept of neighborhood. This once referred to a confined geographical area in which a man lived, worked, and found his recreation. Now the neighborhood has become segmental along the lines of each function. Most men are involved with a different group of neighbors as they move from the area of residence to work to the social group to sports. Locality no longer defines all of one's neighbors. And mobility further assures a changing array of residential neighbors. We're talking then about these three areas, political life. Much has been written about the active role that Lutheran Christians should play in political life. At this point, we're not talking about calling people to consider politics as their career, But rather, we're asking about something on a slightly lower level. We're asking that each Christian consider his own local responsibility for corporate decisions that are made in one's neighborhood and city, and on another level, for those decisions made in state and nation. Such involvement necessitates a reconsideration of positions that have long been cherished by the average Christian. Most of us do not want to become involved in areas of controversy. We want all people to think well of us. While we're conscious of being viewed as representatives of a local church, we are further concerned that our stand not alienate people who might be potential members. Third consideration would place the considerations of evangelism in juxtaposition to community considerations and feel that priority must be given to evangelism. Yet another, those oriented to reacting against power being exercised over them have great difficulty in functioning responsibly when power is given to them. And I add parenthetically, brethren, the source material of the scriptures, the confessionals, the writing of Luther, are those which do not envision our world in which power is not something over there that we are obedient to, but now we exercise part of that power. It's something which is given to us, and therefore we are responsible for it. Increasingly, laymen, by definition of their positions, are going to be called upon to commit themselves to certain decisions. And can we say it so that we all hear it and then increasingly, these decisions will demand taking sides. Neutrality will simply negate any positive influence. I think I am as sympathetic as any one of you in the room to all of the dangers attendant, but I don't see any alternative. The relationship of a Christian and a job is likewise grown in complexity. In the past, pastors often were of marginal assistance, aiding a man to grow in his understanding of the implication of the faith on the job. While the union man in the factory was facing a particular issue, usually involving conflicting communities of people who would be either aided or harmed by a decision, the pastor rarely could offer help beyond statements of the most general character. Isn't it true? Because most of the clerical advice pertained to a personal witness to Jesus Christ in the setting of the factory, during free time, or pointed toward a type of Christian perfectionism. Most Christian men saw little opportunity for being Christians on the job. And yet the faith speaks to many of the deeply ethical problems with which modern industry is wrestling. The relationships of the craftsman of an earlier day were, at least as we see it, much more clean-cut. Has it struck you today a given worker is responsible to many communities of men in opposition to one another? And so simply to say to be loving and fair to your neighbor is of no earthly help. For I, as a worker, am responsible in the same moment to my employer, to my union, to my family, to the customer, to the general community, to the governmental agency which may be exercising special control, and to my own skills as a professional or a craftsman. And the answers that I need as such a worker will not come from abstract pronouncements, but they begin to emerge as fellow Christians, including those who know the intricacies of the work situation as well as the faith in death, wrestle together in making both immediate and long-range decisions. I like the church strengthen its witness to members engaged in business and industry. As one illustration, I would point to the Detroit area, to the Detroit Industrial Mission. Many of you know the local Episcopalian Bishop of Michigan, who is one of the key founders of the DIM. He saw the need clearly. In his one sentence, we have in America an industrial society dominated by giant corporations. Yet the church has no relevance to the great industrial society. The result, he said, is that the tremendous insights of our spiritual heritage are not applied to industry. It was in order to re-win the world of work as a specific area of Christian concern that the Detroit Industrial Mission was begun some 8 years ago. The staff meets with men in approximately 24 industry-related endeavors in the city of Detroit. Its parish includes the production line as well as the executive suites. Their task is not to convert or to argue the merits of a church, but rather to highlight the moral dimensions of the decisions which these men are making. The hourly wage workers meet during lunch breaks, and they talk over union elections, job security, the implication of politics. White-collar workers meet to discuss such items as costs, employee relations, promotion policy. What is a vertical dimension and interpretation to this? Managers tend to deal with subjects even broader in scope, questioning the relationship of their industry to the broader society. A group like Monsanto, once again, is affecting this culture in a way that few of us are going to be able to appreciate. The clergy members of the staff are there to prod and provoke, to serve as theological resource. They seek to bring men to take a position on the political and economic issues they face. The last area, and this is the second time I've tried to talk about leisure, this time we decided we had better quit. The same this area of leisure, brothers, one that's going to be facing us. Many of you have the feeling, I wish this were one of my problems in life. Somebody has put notice is the usual pace of the church's finding relevance. We just caught up and said, we've got to do something about industrial society. At the very moment that the society has moved on and said, this isn't a problem, it's what we're going to do with leisure, then 3% of the population with machines will be able to produce all of the goods which the entire culture can possibly use. And if you need more, you simply run the machine an extra 3 minutes and it's done. Well, somewhere in here, given our understanding of man and work, we have another whole great area. And this is one that, you know, you can dream about and life gets bad. One of the big problems of more people is the problem of leisure.
danger in sin,
which you've suggested. We've said that there is a danger, and we try to point this out, of walking this line. However, when you say disciple of the nations, this is more than just, I suppose to use this word, although there's a danger of being misunderstood, is not simply evangelizing and preaching the gospel in such a way that we're making connections and we keep going, the baptizing with the fire hose. We've always said there is much more involved, and what we're trying to ask is, how then do we do this? Dr. Reeve Anders, in this last 2 years, I have spoken with more laymen from more denominations than I would care to talk about right now, but these people have said, I am facing this decision, and my church has been of no help whatsoever. The only evening sessions are how I discipline my kids. But here I am making a decision which is affecting 10,000 people. I want to be a Christian in this. I fail to see this as frittering away time. But here we are asking for men who are Christians, who have a tremendous responsibility in applying the faith, and for the other. Indeed, the law does not change people, but we said the law acts also as a curb. In the area of civil rights, for example, there is an area where we're talking fundamentally about justice. And we're saying because God has created man, you cannot do this. And it's more than enacted law or constitution. There is a dimension far deeper. And we're asking, is the church not to say this? Is it only the humanitarian who is to speak to this thing? I would see this as not setting up a potential straw man that each of us can easily stand, but rather to see that we're not to move out of one area of irrelevance into another, indeed, but rather to ask how this discipline is going to go on in all of us.